wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, Francis was joined by AUT Professor Marcus Jones talking about zero COVID countries, amateur astronauts in space, and protein synthesis anti-aging research. Marcus began talking about the future of zero COVID or elimination countries.
First topic is about COVID, as usual. And there's a big question, I think probably a lot of people are thinking about this now, is that can supposedly zero COVID countries like New Zealand continue to keep the virus at bay once they reopen? And, you know, and how is that going to happen? Because at some point, I guess, we have to open our doors and open and start letting people in and loosening some of the restrictions. And the question is, what will happen then? Presumably COVID will come into New Zealand, but how will we cope? And so some of the strategies used in countries like New Zealand and other countries in Asia and in the Pacific region may not be so sustainable in the long run. So some of the countries that have been most successful at keeping out COVID-19 are looking at ways to start reopening, sort of gingerly lowering the barriers that protect them while minimizing the risk that the disease will become endemic. And so New Zealand is obviously a great example. China, Australia, Singapore, Taiwan are all countries that have had, with varying degrees of success, more restrictive policies trying to keep COVID out. They managed, again, to some degree, to quash outbreaks early on using lockdowns. And for the most part, people in those countries have been able to live a near normal lifestyle for most of the time. And this has obviously dramatically lowered the per capita death rate. So comparing countries like Australia and New Zealand with the United States and other countries in Europe, which have used vaccines and other measures to try and blunt the infections, you see a much, much smaller death rate, which is just amazing. But the spread of the very much more infectious Delta variant, which we're seeing at the moment, and also the economic burden of keeping our borders closed, you know, the fatigue of lockdowns and also the increasing availability of the vaccines are sort of changing the equation compared to where we were 12 or 8 ago. And in the long term, obviously zero COVID or excluding basically outsiders is not really economically sustainable. And so countries are going to need to test out different approaches to find the right balance between infection prevention and control and normalizing sort of activities in society. So Australia and New Zealand are sort of good examples, but they had, we had sort of similar strategies to begin with, but now they're sort of diverging quite sharply. Australia is in the midst of a pretty awful Delta-driven outbreak with, you know, close to 2,000 new cases every day. And that all started with a single infection in Sydney, and New South Wales just wasn't able to get on top of it quite quickly enough, hopefully, unlike New Zealand. And now really nationwide elimination is not an option anymore. And also the lockdowns that have been operating in other states in Australia have led to pretty big and sometimes violent demonstrations. So on the 6th of August, the Australian government approved a national COVID transition plan that eliminates or abandons the elimination strategy. And that's backed by modeling that shows that restrictions relax without overburdening the healthcare system once about 70% of the population is fully vaccinated. And more freedoms are possible as that number increases. So when they hit 80%, they'll roll back some more of the restrictions and so on. And how that plan is actually implemented is controlled by the 8 states and territories in Australia. But what's going to happen is that Australians will have to accept an increase in severe cases and probably in deaths. And some consensus on what a community will accept, the community that's also been used to much lower, until very recently, much lower death rates, is required. And New Zealand is, so far, at least being able to stick with its elimination strategy. And that has been, up until now, at least more successful than Australia's. Fingers crossed, we can eliminate the current outbreak. And it's been able to do this because it's been able to act quite rapidly and very decisively. And the lockdowns have been very strict. And in New Zealand, advisory panel really staying the course is the best option at age. But looking forward, increasing the vaccination coverage and improving the contact tracing could allow some of the strictest controls to be relaxed. Currently, we're at about about 40% of New Zealanders over age 12 are fully vaccinated, but they're aiming for about 80 to 90% coverage by the end of the year. And that level could set the stage for allowing vaccinated individuals entering the country to skip quarantine sometime next year. And if they agree to things like repeated testing and tracking and things like that. Because vaccinated people can still be infected with COVID, it is inevitable that people carrying the virus will enter New Zealand on a regular basis when the borders start opening, and there will be some community transmission. But they're still thinking that stamping out the resulting outbreaks could be or should be feasible.
Okay.
Yeah. And Australia and New Zealand are sort of two ends of the spectrum at the moment. China, Taiwan, Singapore are both developing strategies, to try and do this sort of the same thing. So that's where we are.
All fingers crossed for elimination this time around. And I guess that's encouraging news if we get our vaccination rates up as quickly as we can. Yeah. Let's move on to the second story about the four amateur astronauts that have splashed down successfully in the Atlantic after 3 days in space.
Yes, so this was a SpaceX mission, and it's called Inspiration 4. Four amateur astronauts returned to Earth after 3 days in orbit. They splashed down successfully in the Atlantic Ocean, and they were the first private all-civilian team ever to orbit the Earth. So as you probably know, Virgin Galactic and Jeff Bezos's company, Blue Origin, both launched privately paying, or at least private citizens, into space, or at least above the atmosphere, but they didn't go into orbit. They just went up and then came back down again. Whereas these guys orbited the Earth quite a lot of times, actually. They went for three days orbiting. And so they're the first private team, and they landed off the coast of the state of Florida after about 7 o'clock local time on Saturday, and they landed with parachutes, and SpaceX boats went off to retrieve them. The people on board were led by billionaire, of course, because there's got to be a billionaire involved, called Jarek Isaacman, who's only 38. God, 38. And he is acting as mission commander, and he paid a lot of money, estimated about $200 million to Elon Musk for the privilege, and also to be able to say who came with him. And so he chose the people who came with him, and they were a physician's assistant and childhood bone cancer survivor, an aerospace design engineer, and an Air Force veteran. And those were the three people who went with him. And this was the third time SpaceX has taken humans to space and back. This is obviously the first time they've been private citizens. And it's really a milestone for the space tourism market. And it set a bunch of records. At one point, they had the most people ever in space, because the Chinese had a bunch of astronauts up there. There are six people currently in the space station, plus the three people who were orbiting in this mission. And I think also the record for the number of toilets in space was broken, which is a unique first, but there's toilets on all three of those spacecraft. So the trip will raise funds for St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Tennessee, where one of the astronauts was treated and now works. And all four of them plan to auction objects they took into space, including a ukulele, apparently, which sounds just fantastic.
Yeah. Will you be bidding on the ukulele, Marcus?
No.
Okay. Let's move on to the final story about anti-aging advice from single-celled creatures.
Yeah, I read this. I thought this was quite interesting. So there's a lot of work that's been done looking at extremophiles. So these are living things that like extreme conditions. So microbes that live in hot springs and hydrothermal vents are good examples. And they've long fascinated scientists for their ability to survive under at high temperatures exceeding, say, 100 degrees C and other extreme conditions. But they may actually hold a clue to longevity in much more complex creatures like us. So researchers have found that a genetic mutation that keeps the protein-making machinery of these little tiny organisms from making mistakes that can actually extend the lifespan of flies and worms and yeast that have been engineered to have the same DNA change. And this discovery suggests that errors in protein synthesis might be an important driver of aging. and possibly a target for future drugs that promote healthier aging. So many studies of aging is reducing aging, I guess, is an active area of research, and many studies of the causes of aging and disease have focused on accumulation of mutations in genes, and these are obviously the blueprints for cells, proteins, and other molecules. But far fewer studies have looked at glitches in how each of those blueprints gets translated, which can then create faulty proteins. So key to this translation process is the ribosome inside cells, and this is the part of the cell that uses the DNA's instructions to assemble amino acids into proteins. And when the ribosome makes a mistake, which happens fairly regularly, the resulting proteins may not fold properly, they might stick to each other, and sometimes they can cause damage to cells. And examples, misfolded or aggregated proteins are implicated in Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and a lot of others, other diseases. Now, cells are pretty good at finding and disposing of faulty proteins, but this maintenance process breaks down as we get older. So the question is, would fewer translation mistakes increase longevity? If fewer mistakes were made in the first place, would we live longer? And until the current study, there was no proof that you could take an animal, improve that that translational fidelity, make fewer mistakes, in other words, and then make it live longer. So researchers looked at a part of the ribosome known to be critical for accurate translation, a protein called RPS23. And when analyzing genetic data from species, from cows to gut microbes to all sorts of things, the researchers found the same amino acid at a key position in this ribosomal protein. But there was an exception. Certain species of single-celled organisms that thrive in extremely hot and acidic environments had a mutation that replaced this amino acid with a different one. And the scientists were curious about the effects of this mutation. So the researchers used the gene editor CRISPR, which is a tool we've talked about in the past, to swap it into the genes, the RPS23 genes of yeast, of fruit flies, and of a tiny roundworm. And all of these organisms with the new mutation had fewer protein synthesis errors and than the unmodified controls. And all three of the organisms could also survive at higher temperatures. But most surprisingly, all three of them lived between 9 and 23% longer.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty surprising. So the mutants also seemed healthier as they aged compared with their controlled counterparts. Older flies with the mutation were better able to climb, and older modified worms produced more offspring. It's not clear how the mutation improves a ribosome's accuracy, and it's unclear why only these extremophiles, or these creatures that only live in these extreme temperatures, have this mutation. One possibility is that this genetic alteration comes at a cost, which must outweigh the benefits in less extreme environments. So hot conditions make proteins more prone to misfolding, which puts extra pressure on an organism to make accurate proteins. But putting that mutation into yeast and flies and worms actually delayed their growth. And that could actually be costly if an organism needs to develop quickly to compete with other species for resources. So that may explain why we haven't evolved to have this mutation. Because we need to grow up faster. And so there are examples of some drugs that are known to improve protein translation and have been shown as a side effect to extend lifespans in animals. An example is rapamycin. It isn't widely considered to be a viable anti-aging treatment for humans, in part because of a lot of side effects, including immune suppression and risk of infections. But scientists are now motivated to screen other compounds for their effects on translation accuracy so that they improve the accuracy at which proteins are produced from the sort of the script given by the DNA.
Fascinating, as per usual, but interesting to see where that research goes in the future.
Yes, well, an extra 20% lifespan, that could be quite significant.
Yeah, absolutely. Marcus, thank you so much, and enjoy your takeaways if you're getting them this evening.
I absolutely will.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.